Now, meditation is one of the great competitive sports because we all end up, we all arrive at the same time, right? The point is to be in the present moment, and we all arrive in the present moment exactly at the same time. So it's a wonderful, I feel, sport. So, can you hear me okay? Speak, not working, I can't hear me, huh? The speaker's not working, or can you turn it up a little bit?
Let's see.
Is it working now? Better now?
Maybe it's a little bit low on me, so.
So, does anyone have any questions or comments before we begin today? Great.
I'm having a hard time finding feelings when I meditate, being aware of what they are. It's very apparent, physical feelings, but emotional states I'm finding very difficult to identify. And last week when we were doing some guided imagery, I had a sensation of real fullness in my belly, and I just felt like I was being held, like, from the inside. And then I started to have some feelings about that, and I was saying, oh, I've been waiting for this, I've needed this my whole life, and was really sad and really overwhelmed by that. But then later, when you were talking about it, I realized that the thing that had made me feel overwhelmed wasn't the state or the sensation, but the story I was telling about it. And that if I had not launched into the story, then I would have had this wonderful feeling of being met and held without the sadness that
Beautiful.
Came along with it. So that, I mean, that was an experience of identifying where I was having feelings about my story. But that, I haven't been able to distinguish
feeling.
Any emotional states this whole
So on one hand, you say you were not able to distinguish emotional states.
Yeah, I don't feel any feelings like sadness or happiness or worry or anything. I feel like I can hear myself think. I can hear, you know, or obsess or daydream or I feel sensations in my body and I hear sounds, but I'm not identifying any feeling states.
Is there a problem?
I don't know. It's odd.
Are you usually an emotional person?
Yeah.
So it's peculiar to this week that you're not feeling much.
I kind of wonder if my emotionalism is a mediated experience. I wonder if I really do have a lot of connection to my most felt states, or whether I have connection to the stories that I tell about my felt states.
It could be. It would be fascinating to look into that and bring your mindfulness to bear on that. I'll get to know that more. I mean, certainly you had emotions last week when you said you felt sadness.
Mm-hmm.
You felt that quite acutely. And other times in your life you feel emotions. The relationship between our story making, our thoughts, interpretations, and emotions, it's a kind of a two-way exchange. Sometimes it's very clear that our emotions come from the stories we make about what's happening. And sometimes we make stories based on the emotions we're happening. And so kind of, you know, and sometimes they kind of follow each other in loops. So, for example, you know, if you're walking down the street and you see, in the dark shadows of an alley, you see the shadow of a figure approaching you and you feel afraid, and then you start making stories. Oh, it must be, some kind of hoodlum who's going to mug me now. I'm sure that's what it is. And that would be terrible because I have all my life savings in my handbag. And if I lose my life savings, then I'll be homeless. And if I become homeless, then no one will love me and I won't get a shower. And then you get more afraid. And And then you notice that you're afraid of, you know, everybody on the street suddenly becomes, you know, terrifying because you think they're seeing you through the filter of being a homeless person because obviously you're on the edge of it. And you know. And the fear kind of triggers all the story making. And finally, you have the courage to look down the alley and find out it's a little kitty cat that somehow there's a light that shines from below and blows it up on the wall. And, you know, it seems much bigger than it actually is. So we can, you know, stories can arise from the initial fear. And then those story making then can initiate a whole other slew of emotions in response. So what starts the emotional spiral? You know, what's the chicken or the egg? We can't always know. Sometimes it's obvious that you're sitting here very peacefully and not a care in the world. And then you remember a girlfriend or boyfriend from high school. Just their name passes across. And the next thing you know, you're furious. You know, because you have the story, oh, that person that she did or he did that to me. And it's very clear that the emotions are being born from reliving the story. And so in that case, the story is first. So how much of our emotions are mediated through concepts and stories is a fascinating investigation, and probably much more than most people realize. Yes?
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how or when or if the outcome becomes really like the serial meditation becomes somewhat more deterministic. So, for example, I sit down and meditate, and the outcome of that, in typically defined terms, right? It just is near random, right?
The outcome of sitting, you sit for 30 minutes,
yeah.
And what happens in the 30 minutes is completely random what might happen. So, if I could use different language, this maybe works for me better.
Okay.
So, if I could repeat back to you. So, what you're saying is that your experience in meditation is quite varied, and you sit down, and there's a wide range of things you might experience in any given sitting. Any other question?
Given that most of my meditation occurs by myself, I don't really see that changing. It obviously occurs by oneself for everyone here, right? Everyone does it, but usually I'm doing it in my garage or den by myself. I'm not sure that I really have the tools to sort of get in the current that's going to get me to that place and not just get wheeled off into the eddies that I do now.
Great. That's a good question. They're all good questions. The and the answer is yes and no, you know, in all kinds of ways. Meditation is not just a single unitary kind of thing that you sit and meditate, one thing happens. There's lots of different, just like human, just like life. You don't expect life, you know, you get born, you don't expect everybody to be cookie cutter kind of life. You know, you get the manual and everybody has the same experience. Or you wake up one day, you don't expect to have the same experience every day of your life. You expect some variation, and sometimes there's a lot of variation, unexpected variation. And meditation is kind of like a microcosm of ordinary life, and with a chance to be able to kind of have a magnifying glass to really be with it and see it clearly for what it is, And because it's kind of a laboratory of, in a microcosm, it's kind of a laboratory of life, there's a possibility of developing wisdom and freedom in our relationship to life. It's one of the best laboratories for doing that. So certainly some people have the ability to cultivate and develop their mind's capacity to get concentrated. And so you develop that muscle, and that muscle then is available more often than not. So you sit down and meditate more often than not, a person can actually use that concentration muscle to get very concentrated and very still, very calm. And it can be used for all kinds of healthy and unhealthy purposes. One of the unhealthy purposes is avoidance. Because people who can get concentrated in meditation, everyone who can get concentrated sooner or later will use that concentration state, like focusing on the breath really intently, in order to try to avoid some bad thing that they want to feel. They're depressed, they're sad, they have physical pain, and they just know they can just blast out of it by getting in a concentrated state. So it can be unhealthy to keep avoiding things if too much. But it can also be very helpful to be concentrated because it gives you kind of a stability to actually look at things in a way that normally you couldn't. So it's like looking into a pond, and if it's stable and clear, then you can see to the bottom. But if it's agitated, you can't see to the bottom. So it's useful to develop a concentration, and that's a muscle that comes with time. Sometimes it takes, months and years to really develop it. Sometimes that capacity to develop, be calm and present and concentrated, develops so slowly that you don't notice it from day to day. And what I recommend for someone who's new to meditation is to meditate for 6 months on a daily basis, and then stop for a week. And then you might notice what an effect it has on you. You notice it becomes kind of like a lubricant in your days. It keeps you more at ease, a little more calm, a little more present. And it kind of helps you be more centered. But you hadn't noticed how that it snuck up on you. But if you stopped cold for a week, now I feel a little more off, and things aren't working quite as well for me. I'm more reactive. So there can be progress. There can be things that happen. But even for the best meditators, the mind is the mind, the psyche, the inner life has a life of its own, has a mind of its own. And there's not the idea of linear progress in the spiritual life is if you hold on to that idea, you're going to suffer a lot. The spiritual life unfolds in spirals and loops and ups and downs, and you can have great spiritual openings and great ecstasy and great releases and whatever, and then almost because of that, that's followed by a very difficult period. It's almost like these great openings allow the psyche to relax, and some of the defensiveness in the psyche kind of falls away, and then the deeper things that were hidden or repressed bubble to the surface. And so you can't always expect, a program, and you can't always choose to be so directive. You can, there are, I went to a dentist last week, and I was going to ask about not using any Novocaine, but he kind of beat me to the punch. But I asked him after he had the Novocaine in my mouth, and he said that I was planning not to. I didn't want to use it. And he said, "Oh yeah, sometimes I have meditators who come here, and they don't use Novocaine. I give them a few seconds to." Just to kind of do their thing, he says. And then I'm amazed because I expect them to not want to talk to me or not want me to talk to them. But they're fine. They're just in their, whatever, they're in their state. And they can be, I treat them normally and I talk to them. And they have the ability to, they've cultivated that ability, that familiarity with themselves to use their mind. So that's the yes part of your answer. In a sense, you can cultivate this ability. The no part is that it's just life. You never know what's going to happen. And probably the more profound thing that happens in meditation and mindfulness life is that it's not really important what happens to you. And you can't always choose what's going to happen to you in meditation or in life. What's important is how you hold it, how you relate to it. And it's how you relate to your experience is where you're going to suffer or not suffer. So if you... did I tell you the simile of the two arrows?
Yeah.
Right. So the way you relate to it, we add the second arrow, we suffer. Or can we relate to things with open mind, open heart? Can we relate to it with kindness, with a kind of acceptance, with an allowance, with wisdom, without grasping onto it? Can we relate to things in a nonviolent way? The how we are in relationship to what goes on is more important. So I remember once a somewhat famous meditation teacher, many years meditation practice, said that even for him, sometimes his meditation was like being at the rodeo. And even though he had years and years of practice, sometimes he knew a successful period of meditation was because he didn't leave his seat. That was a success because it was so wild and tumultuous inside. And he wasn't judging himself by saying, well, I wasn't concentrated enough or still enough. The fact that he had enough presence to not move in the midst of all this turmoil, that was a good meditation for him. And then other times I know he goes and sits and he gets very concentrated and goes into amazingly, you know, pristine states of mind. And it's not always in his control. Another friend of mine who's also a very good ability to get concentrated, kind of comes naturally to him and can go into deep states of concentration pretty easily, said that he had kind of a conflict with someone that it was a very severe conflict where this person kind of took away his own work that he'd been working on for a long, long time and kind of claimed it for his own, and he lost the use of his own work. And he said it took him 6 months before he can get into a concentrated state again, because that his attachments, his anger and fear agitated his mind for 6 months, you know, in order to get into those pristine states of concentration. So how you are is more important than what you are. And in some schools of Buddhism, like some schools of Zen, it's nothing to do at all about what you're experiencing. Your experience is not important. It's really the presence you bring to your experience. And in some ways, the more varied your experience is in meditation, the more you're exercising and learn that muscle of presence, learning how to bring presence to whatever arises. And that translates over into daily life. You bring that capacity of presence. So is that a confusing answer, or is that a helpful answer, or a little bit of both? Yes or no again? Okay. Yes. It's related to the attitude, yeah. So what's the attitude you have to it? Is it an attitude of being oppressed by experience, or fighting the experience, or striving or pushing against it, or expecting it to be different, or, you know, expecting it, you know, for some wonderful thing? Or is it being an adverse attitude to what's going on, covetous attitude of what's going on, or, you know, as opposed to an attitude of just not being in conflict? One of the basic things we're looking for in meditation is to find an attitude that's not in conflict with what's happening. That doesn't mean that we don't see that things shouldn't be certain ways and we don't say no. But you can say no without feeling of conflict. It's an art. No, sometimes you have to say no. I mean, like I'm struggling to learn this as a parent of a five-year-old. Sometimes my gut reaction is to say no, and if, you know, kind of almost violently, no, you can't do that. You know, because I know that gets his attention, you know, and he cowers him, but I don't think it's a very healthy way of parenting. But he can't do it. I know I can't just, oh, it's fine, you know. You know, whatever you want to do is fine. You know, that doesn't work either. So, you know, how can I say no that's not violent, that's a non-violent? How can I say no where I'm not in conflict with a person and, you know, where I'm tight and contracted, but just... So, you know, we do that to ourselves, too. And this is a very important part of Buddhist meditation practice, is learning how not to be in conflict with our own experience, with ourselves. So, like, many people are in conflict with themselves. If there's some aspect of yourself that you don't like, like if you're, say you're shy, and you're really embarrassed by being shy, and you hate yourself for being shy, then you're actually, you know, you're fighting yourself, you're in conflict with yourself. And that's very unfortunate to me. You're never going to win if you're fighting yourself, right? Someone has to lose. And so the idea of learning not to be in conflict with our experience. In shorthand, in Buddhism, we often talk about acceptance as being a very important part of the meditation practice, learning to be accepting of our meditative experience. But acceptance is a little bit problematic because it suggests to people you're supposed to be condoning of things, like everything's okay. And we don't mean that at all. What we mean is that we have a non-violent relationship to what's going on. We're not in conflict with what's going on. And then we find the wise way of responding and, you know, no or yes or whatever has to be has to happen. So, for example, sometimes, you know, like, you know, I get angry, and hopefully, you know, in my best, I'm mindful that I'm angry, very aware of it. I don't repress it and deny it. I know it's there, and then I try. You know, I have an attitude of acceptance of that part of myself. I'm not going to be in conflict with myself for being angry. I'm not going to put myself down because I'm angry. But I also want to act on the anger. And I say, okay, this is not wise. It's not useful to act on this. Anger happens to be what's happening. And I'm not going to be caught by it. I'll try my best not to be caught by it. And given that I'm angry in this situation, what's the wise thing to say? What needs to be said here? What needs to be done? Maybe I need to say no to someone, you know, or tell someone, you know, when you did that, that was difficult for me. But the acceptance means, you know, so especially in meditation, when we're sitting still, the attitude, how can it be unconditionally accepting of what's happening right now? How can it be completely not in conflict with this present moment experience? And that's a big part of what we're trying to learn in meditation. A lot of people think that meditation is about becoming calm or concentrated or blissed out or something. But I think the most profound thing you can learn to do is to learn how not to be in conflict with anything that arises. And in deep spiritual, in the kind of depth of spiritual life, what we find is that even something as seemingly innocent as the ego, the attachment to self, the self idea of self-image, how we want to represent ourselves to the world around us, how we want to represent ourselves to ourselves, all the shoulds and shouldn'ts about the self that we carry with us, that also entails being in conflict with ourselves, with reality. And so the very practice of learning to let go of any conflict with our inner experience leads to very, very deep, if you follow that trail, leads to very, very deep level of peace and freedom, where even the ego, the conflict that is the is that's kind of the you know, that gives birth to the problematic sense of self, evaporates also. This make sense to you all? Not make sense? It's okay?
Does it mean that this sort of meditation has a limited purpose?
Has a what?
Has a limited purpose, like on the point that we have to...
Has a limited purpose, like?
To go further than that, if you want to go further than the point you'd reach, if you had to sort of abandon conflict, you would have to give away this notion of ego. So this sort of meditation practice would not lead us to that point. Is that what it means?
This particular meditation practice, as you know, it's in the way that in Buddhism, this is the meditation practice, the Vipassana, the insight meditation practice, which is classically understood, even down to this day, as the practice that leads you to enlightenment. There's a lot of other Buddhist meditation practices, but they're adjuncts and supports that help shepherd the mind in the direction of enlightenment. But enlightenment itself only comes through the insight practice.
Right. I guess what I meant was... you said you would have to face this notion of ego at some point in time.
Yeah.
So practicing like this, like we are practicing, I mean, there is this notion of self and who I am, and it is not going to go away by just sitting 30 minutes here, right? Mm-hmm.
Oh, that way. It can be extremely effective to sit 30 minutes a day, and perhaps if you do that for 20, 30 years. It'll slowly build momentum and the power, and you'll have, you know, maybe be able to penetrate into some real depths of the psyche and find a deep kind of freedom. Some people are kind of spiritual adepts, you know, great geniuses spiritually. It doesn't take much. For most people, in order to follow this particular path to the kind of spiritual depths that Buddhism is pointing towards, it requires much more than just sitting 30 minutes a day. And it often takes, for example, going on long retreats. Meditation retreats, 10 days or 3 months or, you know, maybe longer sometimes. And doing a series of them, perhaps, so that the mind can get really concentrated, very still. Because the mind needs to be very concentrated and very still in order to see into the kind of the subtlest roots of what how the psyche is constructed, how the psyche, the attitudes or the fears that hold the psyche together. And so it really takes a very concentrated mind to do that. And that comes from being on retreat. That makes sense? So it's the same practice, you just do it in a different way, more intensely.
You know, if
I think it depends on the mental illness. There are people with mental illnesses who found tremendous benefit from meditation, from mindfulness practice. And then occasionally with people, some people with mental illness, meditation is counterindicated. It probably won't be useful for them, or at least not without a lot of support. And for some people for whom, you know, they have a mental illness and just simply they can't get into it. It just doesn't work, you know. It doesn't cause any problems, but it also doesn't, you know, somehow they can't get they can't quite engage in the practice. So if a person has a very severe mental illness, they might want to come and talk with a meditation teacher or a therapist or someone first about what they want to do, because they're, you know, meditation can open up realms of the mind that, you know, if you're unstable to begin with, can be a little bit frightening or difficult. It's quite common for people to come and retreat, for example, and be afraid they're going crazy. And sometimes that comes with the most severe versions of it, not because I've seen is not the most common scenario I've seen, is that they themselves, I don't perceive any, you know, particularly mental imbalance or anything that shows me signs that they're going to go off the deep end or something. But growing up, they had a sibling or a mother who was institutionalized for mental difficulties. And this was so traumatizing, so frightening for them, that they'd be so frightened of even getting close to that possibility for themselves. And so as they get let go and as they settle and get concentrated in meditation, this fear, this deep fear shows itself. And then they have to kind of work through that fear. So the attitude is important. And classically in Buddhism, this meditation practice of mindfulness is taught together with a practice, meditation practice called, in Pali, in Buddhist language, called metta, or loving kindness. And classically, a person would actually do 5 or 10 minutes of this loving kindness meditation before they would do mindfulness meditation in order to cultivate an attitude of friendliness towards themselves and their experience. And it said that the attitude of being friendly to experience is one of the most conducive ones for going deep into the meditation practice. So if you're friendly, you're not in conflict. So let's start with the meditation now. So sitting upright in an alert posture. Never underestimate the importance of having an alert posture when you meditate. You don't want to do that in a way that, you know, is tense, but alert. Gently close your eyes. And take a few moments just to take stock with yourself. How you are. How you are in your body, how your body feels. How you are in your heart, your feelings, in your mind, concerns that you have. And then take a few moments now to have thoughts of goodwill towards yourself. Friendly thoughts. Just think kind things about yourself. Maybe it's kind wishes, wishes for your own happiness. Thoughts of goodwill, perhaps an attitude or a disposition of goodwill towards yourself. Perhaps a softening of your body a little bit as you become kindly disposed, tender towards who you are. Tender, even if you're filled with conflict or impatience or anger or sadness or something, to have a kind of tenderness or softness, kindness to yourself. And then slowly and mindfully, caringly, take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Feeling your body as you breathe in, how it feels. As you exhale, let go of your thoughts, let go of tension. Let go into gravity. Full of taking a deep breath into your chest, your belly, into your shoulders. And as you exhale, relaxing the shoulders. And then letting your breath return to normal. And breathing in a normal way. Spend another few moments scanning through your body to see if there's any other places in your body where you might soften or relax the muscles. Even if it's just a little bit. Maybe the forehead, the eyes, the jaws. You might try again on the shoulders. Perhaps the chest and the rib cage. And perhaps the belly can be relaxed, let it hang forward. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of what happens in the body when you breathe. Become aware of your breathing. The very simple rhythm of breathing in and out. Connecting to the experience of breathing and then hanging in there with it. One breath after the other. If there are thoughts in the background, and you can keep the breathing in the foreground, just stay emphasizing the breathing. Be interested in it. Hang in there with it. Coast on it. Perhaps the image of a cork bobbing up and down in the waves. Awareness rests there in the waves of the breath, rising and falling with each wave of breath. No matter what happens when you're sitting here, there's no need to be in conflict with anything. No need to judge it negatively. See if you can have a very broad-minded, allowing approach that helps you relax with whatever is going on. If the mind wanders off in thought, then lovingly, smilingly, begin again with the breathing. Let go of the thinking and begin again with your breath. Very softly in the mind, you can label the in-breath in and the out-breath out as a way of nudging or encouraging the awareness to be with the breathing, to sense it and feel it. Especially as you exhale, let go of any thoughts that have crept in. There's no need to think about anything when you meditate. You can trust that it's enough just to be with your breathing, breathing in and breathing out. the first principle of mindfulness is simply to be aware of what's happening. If you're aware of, clearly aware of what's happening, it's really enough. If something takes you away from the breathing, be clearly aware of what that is. Body sensations, feelings, thoughts. And then having clearly been aware of what it is, then begin again with your breathing. If you have trouble being with your breath, then be clearly aware of yourself as having the experience of having trouble being with the breath. Notice what that feels like, how that happens. Notice what it's like to have trouble with being present. How the mind slips away into thought. How the breath becomes disconnected from awareness, becomes vague. Now, a little exercise for the end of the meditation session. So let go of your breath for now, keeping your eyes closed. And to the best of your ability, listen carefully to the thoughts that come through your mind. If the thoughts vanish as you try to listen to them, then just be with your breath until they reappear. And listen to your own thinking. Be aware of it, sense it. Almost like as if you're listening to someone else's voice. And see if you can pick up, be aware of the quality of that inner voice. Is it soft? Is it gentle? Slow? Is it harsh? Is it judgmental? Is it fast? Is it hesitant? Is it speedy? Is it kind? Is it unkind? As you're listening or sensing the experience of thinking, does it vanish? In the space where there's no thoughts, what's there? Is there peace? Is there fear? Are there problems? If the thoughts persist, what's the felt sense of thinking? Occasionally you can be aware of a physical way in which thinking feels in your body. It feels like physically to be thinking. Especially if you're really preoccupied by something. It could be pressure and tension maybe around the eyes or the forehead and the head. Tightening of the little tightening of the shoulder or the jaws. Sometimes an upwelling feeling, an uprising feeling of energy. Maybe from the belly up into the chest or up the spine, up the neck. If it's available to you, hang out with a physical felt sense of what thinking is like, what happens when you think in your body. Listening to your thinking. If you can become aware of your thoughts, label them. Thinking. It's very quiet in your mind. Name them when they occur. Or if it's really obvious what kind of thoughts they are, name them. Remembering or planning. Impatient thoughts. Worrying thoughts. Kind of very matter-of-factly, very simply, name the experience of thinking. And then let go of this exercise and spend about 3 breaths with the breath, being aware of the breathing, and then I'll ring the bell. What I'd like to do is to review and expand on the instructions to include thinking as part of the practice, and then take a couple of minutes to see if any of you want to talk about what happened during that meditation, what happened when you brought your attention to your thinking in these ways. And then I'll go on. So the basic practice of mindfulness entails being clearly aware of what's happening in the present moment without being in conflict with what's happening in the present moment. However, most of our minds are somewhat agitated. It's difficult to stay concentrated in the present moment, to stay in the present moment, because the mind wanders away in thought so easily. So we use the breathing as an anchor to the present moment, as a tether to the present moment. As long as you're with the breathing, breathing happens in the present moment, so your mind and your awareness is in the present. The breath is a very helpful place to help the mind become quiet, still, and learning how to dwell in the present moment. So we spend a lot of time in mindfulness practice emphasizing being with the breath, concentrating the breath, feeling it, being mindful of the breathing. It's very helpful for most people. However, And if things are in the background of experience, if there's thoughts or feelings or sounds or whatever, and they stay in the background, you can just stay there with the breathing. You might go away a little bit, and you let go of your thoughts, you come back and you stay there, trying to cultivate your ability to stay with the breath longer and longer, for more and more breaths in a row, kind of. Just hanging in there, letting the breath massage you. However, at some point, something comes into the foreground of attention. Something becomes more compelling than your experience of the breathing. It might be some physical sensation. Maybe your knees ache or hurt, or maybe it's an itch, or maybe some nice pleasant sensation bubbles up. Any kind of physical sensation. It could be a sound outside or around in the room that you hear. Or perhaps it's some emotion that arises, some feeling that becomes really strong and much more compelling than your being with the breath. If any of these things happen, then you can let go of the breathing and let these other things become the meditation subject. The place where these are what's happening in the present moment. So you bring your attention to those and learn how to relate to those with an attitude of presence, of non-conflict, kind of acceptance, not making a story of it, but really seeing and feeling. Feeling. Really feeling is a really important part of this. Kind of the felt sense of what this experience feels like. So what's a felt sense of this sensation in your body? Get really close to it. Use your capacity to get concentrated to kind of zero in on it. What is it exactly? And see if you can hold it in a meditative way. Sensation, emotions the same way. Where are the emotions in your body? How do you feel it? Thoughts. Sometimes meditators think that thoughts are the enemies of meditation. And if you're able to, you're only able to successfully meditate if you had no thoughts at all, completely empty of thoughts. And that happens occasionally, the mind becomes so still, it seems like there's no thoughts at all. But that's not necessarily the purpose. You don't need to set that up as a goal for yourself. What we want to do is we want to be able to include thoughts, the thinking, as part of the domain of the mindfulness practice. So one of the principles here is that nothing is excluded from awareness. Whatever is occurring in the present moment is equally a valid subject for meditation practice, for where we wake up, what we pay attention to, where we recognize this is what's happening now. Some people have all these attitudes that, oh, if that dog will only start barking, then I really could get into my meditation. Or if that knee wasn't hurting, then I could really get into my meditation. Or if only that mind would stop talking all the time, then I could get into my meditation. Or if only I stopped feeling, you know, so emotional, then I could get into my meditation. So ideas of what it takes, what you have to get rid of in order to get meditative. The attitude of mindfulness meditation is that's kind of an exclusive attitude. It kind of excludes certain things. The approach in mindfulness meditation is to be very inclusive of everything. Everything's included. Nothing's outside. In fact, I would say that what's considered most sacred in Buddhism is that awareness which has no outside. That everything happens within it. As soon as you have something which is unacceptable for awareness, I'll keep that out, please, then you've lost touch with the sacredness of what Buddhists would call the sacred realm. And so to have an attitude that thoughts are the enemy of meditation or they shouldn't happen gets in the way of that all-inclusive awareness. So what we try to do is to learn how to be mindful of thinking when thinking occurs. So if you just kind of drift off in thought, you're kind of light, you know, chattering of the mind, then it's fine just to let go of it and come back to your breathing. Acknowledge your thinking, come back to your breathing. But if your thought is more powerful than that. It's not, you can't really let go of it that easily. You let go of it and it comes right back. It's kind of compelling. Then let go of the breath and do mindfulness of thinking. Be aware of the fact that you're thinking. Kind of look the event of thinking head on. What you're thinking about, for the most part, is not that important for meditation practice. Just that you're aware, oh, this is thinking. This is a human mind that's thinking. We tend to be so caught up in the stories and the thoughts, the ideas, the interpretations and everything of our thoughts that it's very hard to free ourselves from being lost in that world. And the analogy I'll give is for this, that you maybe understand better what I mean here, is if someone walked around next to you 24 hours a day, all your waking hours, and chattered into your ear, talking to you constantly, you'd probably after a while ask them to please be quiet. They might follow you to the bathroom everywhere you go. Please be quiet. Can you please be still? And probably it'd be hard not to say it in stronger terms after a while, after a few weeks or something. You know, shut up or something. And now if that person who's following you around was as repetitive in what they said as you are with yourself, you'd probably think they should be institutionalized or something, you know. It's even worse, right? You kind of get bored after a while. The amazing thing for most of us is that we can have the same kind of thought, same concern go through our mind 500 times. And it's just as interesting the 500th time as it was the first time. Now, why is that? If someone goes next to you saying the same thing 500 times, you know, after the second or third time, you've lost interest. But in yourself, why is that? Partly it's because most of the kind of thinking we have is often a way in which we're trying to make ourselves safe or create a sense of self, relate the world to ourselves. You know, there's a lot of agendas going on. And so it's very interesting. So we're not actually that interested in the content of our thoughts when we do meditation. When we want to just see the event of thinking. And there's different ways of relating to thinking that's not just connecting to the thoughts, but the content of the thoughts, the ideas. And I try to do that in meditation to give you some sense of that, those possibilities. One is you could just be aware, for example, of the tone of that inner voice, the quality of it. Did some of you discover some interesting qualities or tones to your inner voice? Or is that kind of a, didn't work as an exercise? What did you discover? If you wanted
monotonous?
Drone, kind of a droning quality, yeah?
Mine was the voice of reason.
The voice of reason. And if someone was going next to you 24 hours a day talking to you that way, you wouldn't think it was so kind after a while.
No, I broke up.
You broke up with him. So you internalized it? So other voices, what was the quality of that voice? Is it hard to notice that? No one wants to admit. And, yeah?
Well, a lot of times my internal monologue, especially while I'm meditating, is very aware my right, left knee is higher than my right knee. I'm falling backwards, you know, and my voice is sort of telling me, you're not sitting up, you're not balanced.
So it's kind of constant.
It's supposed to be balanced.
So kind of constant commentary and some judgment of what's happening in the present moment.
Yeah.
Now, if you were listening to someone speaking a foreign language and you couldn't understand their words, and you were listening to the tone, the way they were talking, what would be the tone of that voice?
A little bit naggy, a little bit judgmental.
So you'd hear that in the tone of the voice.
Yeah.
So sometimes it can be one way to connect to the event of thinking besides just being caught up in the thoughts, the ideas, is to listen more carefully. What's this event like? What does it feel like? What's the tone like? And it might be interesting. And sometimes it's quite revealing to discover for some people the tone, the quality of that voice. And they realize, oh, that's not my voice. That's, you know, my mother's voice. I can't believe it. You know, it's always, you know, they realize that there's always this judging, harsh quality going on. All kinds of ways that it can be. The other aspect of thinking that you can pay attention to is what it feels like in the body to be thinking, energetically. This works really well if you've really agitated your thoughts. If you've done something really, you know, something terrible, like, you know, say that you've just been laid off from work, you know, if that's really terrible for you, maybe not. Some people, a few years ago, people were begging to be laid off. And now they don't want to anymore. You know, say you don't want to be laid off. And so, you know, so suddenly you're full of fear and worry and anxiety and thoughts about this, you know, what it means. And it's, you know, it's very compulsive, kind of persistent, the thinking. What does it feel like? You probably feel some tightness somewhere, some contraction. You feel maybe the eyes are squinting or the foreheads are kind of furrowed up, or maybe the shoulders are kind of tight or the neck is tight. Or maybe this feels like 10,000 bumblebees kind of spinning around the head, bouncing around. Energetically, you can feel what it's like to be so caught up in those kinds of thoughts. Even thoughts which are relatively subtle have an energetic or physical aspect to them. But it takes a very subtle mind to pick up the subtle physical aspect of subtle thoughts. But as the mind gets more and more still in meditation, you can sometimes feel the subtle influence of thinking, or subtle way in which thinking manifests physically in the body. So in some ways, you can sometimes feel it in your body. Sometimes there's emotions connected to your thinking, especially if your thoughts are quite persistent. You have the same thoughts over and over again. Like if you're always planning, you notice, I'm always planning. Chances are that there's a worry underneath it. And so sometimes when you pay attention to the event of thinking, you can notice the emotion that's part of it. And then you can ground yourself in the emotion and then maybe feel how the emotion manifests in the body. These are all ways of bringing presence to the experience of thinking without being sucked into thinking further about what you're thinking about. So how to look at the event of thinking, how to be mindful of it and be present for it without being carried away by it. Sometimes you can do it just by looking at it head on, just be aware of thinking, say thinking, just be aware of it. Sometimes you can feel it energetically in your body. Sometimes you can feel it as a voice. Sometimes you can feel it as emotions, as the emotional qualities connected to it. So there's various ways. Some people think more in images rather than in words. So it's more of an image, a vision that they see. And so they can kind of maybe note seeing the image, being aware of how vivid is it or how dull it is. Is it three dimension? Is it multicolored? Is it black and white? You know, what's it like, that visualization, that some people think that way? Yes.
The way you're describing it sounds very busy.
It can be, but it doesn't have to be. This is a little bit of the danger of giving this kind of instructions. The idea is to be very relaxed about what's happening. Sit down and be with your breathing. And then sooner or later, your thinking will become more manifest, become stronger. And when it does that, then you want to bring presence to that event of thinking. When your thinking becomes more prominent, you can come in if you'd like. Please come, or take a seat. You're welcome. So you want to bring kind of presence, a calm, relaxed presence to that experience of thinking. Generally, if your thinking is not so strong, so compulsive, it tends to fade away pretty quickly. Some of you had that experience. Once you became aware of your thinking, it kind of disappeared. But if it doesn't go away so easily, then just hang out there with it. And as you hang out with it, become aware of the scenery. Become aware of what's going on. So, like if you go, you know, across the Golden Gate Bridge on a tour bus, there's all kinds of things to notice. There's the bridge, there's the water, there's the sailboats, there's the fog, there's the marine headlands. You notice all those things. So I'm kind of like painting for you the geography of what you might notice. You might notice, when you're thinking, the tone of the voice. You might notice the physical aspect of it. You might note energetic aspects of it. You might notice the emotional connection to those kinds of thinking. And you don't have to make yourself busy and analyzing what's this and what's that. It's more like you stay relaxed and you're kind of taking it in, okay, taking a wider picture. And what else is going on here? Does that make sense? Does that help at all?
Yeah, I mean, just all of the different analysis that goes with it just
Yeah, I can say.
If I had to do that, then I would feel like I'm trying.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's kind of like learning to ride a bicycle. So at first, it is kind of agitating, kind of you're wobbly. But if you relax, I mean, and once you kind of learn to get the hang, you have to kind of go through that period of where it's kind of wobbly and you're kind of a little hard. But once you get a hang of it, then it becomes easier and easier. So like if you go into some, you know, the Amazon jungle, at first you have to really try hard to be able to see anything. I've been told that people who grew up there can see things, spot things really easily, and you know, in the jungle, you know, in trees, but people from New York City can't see anything. It all looks the same to them. They don't see the details. But if you, after you've been there for some time, it's really easy to see the details because you know it really well. So it might seem agitating at first, but what I recommend is you kind of give it a chance to sink in. And after a while, you'll probably find that actually it helps you to get more and more relaxed, more at ease. Because once you get a handle on your thinking, and the thinking doesn't have the upper hand, when you have control over your thinking in the sense that you can step out of it, you'll probably find how to be at peace. Because it's our thinking that tends to keep us agitated. So you can go through that wobbly period. Yes?
I have two questions. I'll just say both of them. How do you describe the difference between awareness and thought? For instance, if I'm becoming aware of myself thinking, is it a thinking part of me that's aware of it, or is awareness something different from my thought?
Are you aware of what your hand is doing now when you were talking?
Yeah.
Were you thinking about your hand? What your hand was doing? Do you hear the door?
Yes.
So you're thinking about the door? But you're...
But if I heard the sound.
Uh-huh.
But if I were to bring, for instance, the sense in meditation that I would bring to that, it would have more presence to me in my mind, and then it would feel like there was a part of me that was mine. Not necessarily putting a word to it, but a part of me that was mine, that was holding it more clearly.
Yeah, what's wrong with that? So you're saying that if you bring your awareness, so you can be aware of something kind of in the corner of your eyes in a sense, but then you can bring your awareness to bear on it.
Yeah.
Right, so if I hear a sound, I can kind of be aware of the sound, and then I can really be mindful of the sound. Mindfulness means you turn your attention and really take it on, take it in, really there for it. You bring kind of presence to that experience. So there's a lot of things we can be aware of kind of generally. But to really kind of connect to the experience of the breath fully, for example, if you take on the breath, or to take on the experience of sound, or take on the experience of being in a body. My awareness is just kind of the general registering of what's happening. Perception of what's happening, in a sense. And mindfulness is bringing a careful attention to what we're aware of. So mindfulness is different than awareness. But thinking is one step removed from that. Thinking is beginning to analyze and categorize and judge and assign meaning and to what's going on. So for example, if you know when a friend of yours is really present for you physically, you know, they're really there for you, really feel their presence. It's kind of a silent presence, they're really taking you in. Maybe they're not thinking about you very much. Or once I went to a concert, the orchestra in San Francisco, and I noticed in the first kind of third or so half of the concert, it was very hard for me to stay present. I had a lot of thoughts, concerns, and going on for me, and then when I did open my eyes, I was kind of analyzing the orchestra and the layout and, you know, what all kinds of things. So I finally kind of closed my eyes so I wouldn't be thinking about what I saw and tried it in order to kind of be more with the music. But after the intermission, I could come back and then I'd quieted down enough that I wasn't thinking anymore about the music. I was just taking it in a silent way. But I was very mindful, very present for it. I was aware of it, but I was really being very clear presence and really taking it in. So awareness is just a simple, there's a lot of things we're aware of, hardly, you know, just at the corner of our eyes. Mindfulness is when, so you become aware, for example, you become aware of a sound, and then we bring our mindfulness to that sound. We become aware of an itch, and we bring our mindfulness, this careful presence to that experience. But
is mindfulness thinking?
No. You can think and you can know you're thinking. But that knowing is not exactly a thought in the way we usually think of it. So another way of talking about this is, how do you bring a sense of ease and presence to what your experience is? So you have an experience, and then bring a presence to that experience that has a sense of ease and acceptance of that experience. Silent ease, silent presence to that experience. So you don't have to analyze and think about it. You know, occasionally you do a little bit of it. For example, if you say thinking, or if you notice it's planning, it's fine to notice it's planning. And sometimes if you can name the theme that you're thinking about with more precision, it takes some of the power away from it. Planning, remembering, worrying. So you name it that way. Yes?
If you're feeling something like fear or anxiety, is it enough to name it and say, oh, there I go again, you know, I'm feeling some discomfort, fear, or anxiety? Or do you really try to, when you say make it the subject of the medication, do you try to analyze why you're feeling that way?
Oh, no.
What it does to you when you feel that way?
Generally not. I mean, that's a useful exercise at other times, to analyze why you're feeling a certain way and, you know, to look into it. But in meditation, we're not trying to analyze and understand so much as we're trying to develop that capacity to bring an accepting presence to what's there. And so you don't simply want to be aware that you're anxious, but then you want to bring presence to the anxiety and feel the anxiety in your body. What does it feel like to be? Just really feel it. Be with it for a long time. Hold it tenderly, your anxiety. Be with it. Accept it. Don't push it away.
Okay.
And it might be that you feel anxious, you know. I mean, a person can be anxious for a lifetime. But it's very unusual for people to bring a careful, kind presence to anxiety. Just feel it and hold it. And not be impatient, not be in a hurry to get rid of it. And then sooner or later, probably the anxiety will just dissipate on its own if you just feel it. Anxiety continues through time, because we're fueling it with our further thoughts, more often than not. We have more further kind of anxious thoughts. And yes?
I find myself itchy. And I'm sensitive anyway to the itch. I know my friend's porch or whatever. I'm concentrating on the itch. Uh-huh. And so I find that at least every couple of minutes, one or two,
so,
you just itch it, or you just...
No, you don't scratch it, you feel it, itch. You do itching meditation.
It's itching
meditation. You just keep itching? Yeah, you sit there and, okay, itching is a predominant thing. It's the most compelling experience in the present moment. No one's ever died from an itch. So so I'm going to see how to bring a mindful presence to that itch.
I'm not gonna, it just itches more.
Yeah, so that's fine. What's wrong with that?
Ah,
it doesn't have to. And that's the rub. That's the point, the friction. That's the point where practice becomes a real practice, is we notice all these extra attitudes and suffering and irritations and judgments and fears that come into play around the experience. Can you work that edge and find how to be free of all those things so that you can just have an itch, and it's just an itch? If you have a pain, and you know, it's just a pain. It's not all this extra baggage we assign to the pain and weigh ourselves down with. This is a very important point in the meditation practice, is when we notice that our relationship to the experience is one that doesn't allow us to be at ease with the experience. And then we want to be very mindful of that relationship that we have and hold it, so that relationship doesn't work kind of unconsciously or subconsciously to continue to cause stress and suffering in our system. Hopefully that makes sense. Yeah. One of the great practices is called writing out the desire, which is maybe in some ways has greater usefulness than niche. Is find yourself, wait and notice when there's a really good desire. Maybe like if you're an addict, if you like have some kind of something you're addicted to, it's really good for this. It's a really good exercise. And you're something you just normally just can't resist. That urge comes. Whatever. And when you feel that desire, stand still or sit down and don't act on the desire, but instead feel the desire. Feel what it feels like. Feel the desiring. Bring presence in your body. Bring presence in your body for what it feels like for the body to be desiring, for the mind to be desiring. Then you can feel maybe sometimes the power of thinking mind, the energetics, the physicality of it, the compulsion of it, the insistence of it. Just feel all that. Don't do anything. You have to write it out. And if you have to break out in the sweat in order to do that, break out in the sweat. If you have to clench your jaw or clench your, tighten your fist so you don't give in, just write out the desire. And sooner or later, the wave will break. You'll find yourself on the other end of it'll get stronger and stronger and stronger. It'll feel more and more compelling. And all the lawyers in the mind will come out and give you every reason why it has to be now. And right to the peak. And then sooner or later you'll find yourself on the backside of the wave and it'll become peaceful again. And people who have addictions, like to cigarettes or something like that, will report that this is very empowering to them, to realize that they have the capacity to ride out an emotion like that. Just to bring presence and not get caught by it, not to be reactive to it, not to hate themselves for it, just bring presence to it without acting on it. It's a very amazing thing to do. So, itches are like going to the gym. You're learning to do that. There's various reasons why people itch in meditation. There can be just your own reasons. I don't know what they are. But there are other kind of meditative reasons. One is for people who are relatively new to meditation, it's the mind's way of trying to trick you not to be present. The mind, the ego, the fears we have, the emotions we don't want to face, will set up all kinds of things to try to avoid us from really being present for what's really happening with us. Anything, please, anything but face myself. As an itch, I've got to itch or to do this or that. Another reason is that sometimes if people get really calm and concentrated in meditation, itching of the skin is a symptom of concentration. Sometimes you can feel like all these ants are crawling across your skin. It doesn't happen to everyone, but it happens to some people who develop a kind of certain level of concentration. And I remember I was convinced it was in Thailand. There were sometimes ants crawling across you. And I was convinced, there was ants all over my skin. And finally, it's probably just a meditation thing. I've heard about this. No, it has to be ants. It has to be. I'm tracking them going up my... If I open my eyes and there's not a single ant on me. Sometimes people say it's like the skin is kind of crawling across... curling up or something. So, and another reason why itching becomes a big deal is that sometimes we get obsessed by it. And, there's an itch. Oh, not an itch. Oh, my God, an itch. I'll never survive. And, no one else is moving. And I can't move. But I'm so. And things can seem much bigger than they actually are because we get caught up by them. And you have to learn how to kind of, not be caught by things in that way. We're learning how this easeful presence and learn how the tricks of the mind. And after a while, it's just an itch. It's not a big deal. But we magnify it by our preoccupations sometimes. Good luck. Yeah?
This one a lot. I had it this morning. I was meditating where I have to know how many minutes are left. I just have to. And I almost can't stand it. So I just think, don't open your eyes. I have to know how many minutes are left.
That's good you laughed. It's a blessing to be able to laugh at oneself because then you'll never stop being humored. But I think that's a pretty common experience for meditators to go through. And when that happens, I'd encourage you to make that your meditation. And actually take it on as your meditation, that impatience.
It
that,
really felt like I think you were sort of like,
yeah.
I have to know,
yeah.
I can't.
If all you do is write it out, that's quite significant.
Okay.
But what you could also do is bring mindfulness to your body. Feel what the irritation, the impatience. Feel what's going on in your mind. Feel what's going on in your emotionally. Feel what's going on in your body. Feel all that anxiety.
Yeah.
And feel, be very precise and feel, where is it strongest in your body? Can you pinpoint the strongest, where that impulse is in your body strongest? And bring a tender awareness to that presence, to that place in your body.
Okay.
If you don't give careful presence to it, but you kind of hold it at a distance, then it tends to kind of run rampant and you're kind of caught by it. And it's a lot easier to kind of then give in at a weak moment. It is for you. That's all I care. You don't have to. Yes?
The other thing is, I found this out with the first couple. Don't give yourself an opportunity to find out what time it is.
Yeah.
If you don't know, you should stop. If you don't like watching,
yeah. Yeah, the rule in Zen meditation halls is you're never supposed to bring a watch into the meditation hall. And just to wait for the three bells. So you came in late, but Allison has this tape that you can put in your... And then you wait for the three bells. And then you sit there waiting, oh, did I really push the start button? And then there are times when they ring the bells. Wait a minute. I just sat down. How could it be so fast? The mind is amazing. So just be in awe.
At the retreat in December.
Oh, then I slept. Yeah, I kind of...
forgot.
Well, I kind of... I think I fell...
You're all meditating and finally the bell rings. Oh, sorry.
That's very rare. So let me say a few words, more words. And it's almost 9 o'clock, so hopefully you can be a little bit patient. If you're impatient, then you can be mindful of that. And if you suffer because we're going a couple minutes over, that's your doing. I'm not causing you to suffer. I might be the condition for the suffering, but the cause of your suffering is your relationship to what's going on. You believe that? Wow. So, I just wanted to give you a couple of maybe I don't. Maybe I'll do it next week. Sorry, I'm sorry. It's not a big thing, but it's a whole another angle for understanding this whole mindfulness meditation. And maybe it's better just as an introduction next week when we do next week. So next week I'll talk about the secret teaching that I'm going to leave for next week. But I'll talk about how to go further in this practice, how to develop it in daily life and how to apply it in life, and also how if you want to, develop it with greater concentration, how to bring concentration and join the mindfulness with the concentrated state, and how the benefits that come with that. And what I'll leave you with is an analogy. The two things. One is, if any of these instructions seem complicated, which they can, because you heard about mindful of breath and body and feelings and now thoughts, it seems like too much. The default is to go back and be simpler about the instructions. And if you'd be well served by just spending months just with the instructions from the first week. Just staying with the breath. Just doing breath meditation. And then after that, maybe incorporating what goes on in the body. You don't have to do the whole show right away. You can kind of do it slowly and just develop the meditation that way. Or only do mindfulness of thought when it really seems necessary to do it, and really helpful, obviously helpful to do it. So the analogy is that in certain ancient Buddhist paintings, that are very symbolic, the human person is sometimes depicted as a one-room house, a teeny little room, one-room house that has five windows and a door. And this is for the six sense doors that Buddhism posits, the five sense doors that we have, and then that sense door, which Buddhism posits, that lets us be aware of what's going on in the mind. How we can be aware of our thoughts and stuff. And we're like a one room house with these five windows and a door. They're all open. And inside the house, there's an easy chair. And your job is to sit down in that easy chair. And as you sit there, being at ease, you'll notice that various things, various animals and people and flowers and whatever, will appear at the windows and at the door. You'll see them through the windows and the door. Some of them will poke in and come look, stick their kind of head through the window and smile. And some will just be clouds in the distance, but something will happen. And your job is to stay in your easy chair and be very clearly aware and cognizant of what you're seeing there, as opposed to going out towards it, as opposed to going grabbing it or trying to push it away or closing the doors or, you know, doing anything with it. You can. The point is to stay at ease. If you lose your ease, if you leave your easy chair for some reason, then that loss of ease becomes the meditation. You don't beat yourself up. You don't judge yourself as doing the meditation wrong. Rather, this then is included also. This too. That sense, oh, now I'm agitated about this experience. Now I'm trying to shut the door on it or I'm afraid of it. And let that be part of the meditation. Does that analogy make sense? So a meditative experience is to be in that easy chair, be at ease with what's happening, an easeful presence, being aware of what arises in the five, in any of the sense doors. And if something is very compelling at one of the sense doors, then we stay there and bring very careful presence and mindfulness to that experience at the sense doors. But in doing this, make the breathing the place where you do your anchor to the present moment. Stay with the breath. The breath is so invaluable to develop a stability and stillness with the breath. And it takes a long time to become really concentrated on the breathing, but it's really helpful. So I hope this all makes sense. I hope this is helpful and useful. It helps you to not be so caught. It's fascinating not to be caught by your thoughts. It's fascinating to track your thinking a little bit. It's fascinating to watch the relationship between your thoughts and your emotions, your thoughts and your body. It's fascinating to watch the relationship between your thoughts and your what motivates you and your compulsions and, you know, why you decide to do what you do. One of the ways to become free is to learn to become free of your thinking. You don't have to believe every thought. So may you learn how not to believe your thoughts automatically. So thank you very much.